This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past few days, we've heard two important speeches on very different aspects of the war on terror. Last Thursday, at an event to mark the 20th anniversary of the National Endowment for Democracy, President Bush framed his policies in Iraq as part of a global campaign for democracy and freedom. Then, yesterday, in a speech before a meeting co-sponsored by MoveOn.com and the American Constitution Society, former Vice President Al Gore declared that the Bush administration has undermined democracy in this country, and he called for the repeal of the Patriot Act. We're going to listen to excerpts from both speeches this hour and talk about their significance, and we begin with President Bush. His speech last week tried to put his efforts to spread democracy, particularly in Iraq and the Middle East, on the same plane as President Ronald Reagan's determination to roll back communism. At the time, as President Bush noted, President Reagan's campaign was dismissed as simplistic, naive, even dangerous. In the Middle East, the president argued that the lack of democracy and freedom is not a failure of culture or religion, but of misguided political and economic policies, and he criticized the West, including the United States.
60 years of Western nations excusing and accommodating the lack of freedom in the Middle East did nothing to make us safe, because in the long run, stability cannot be purchased at the expense of liberty. As long as the Middle East remains a place where freedom does not flourish, it will remain a place of stagnation, resentment, and violence ready for export. And with the spread of weapons that can bring catastrophic harm to our country and to our friends, it would be reckless to accept the status quo. Therefore, the United States has adopted a new policy, a forward strategy of freedom in the Middle East. This strategy requires the same persistence and energy and idealism we have shown before, and it will yield the same results. As in Europe, as in Asia, as in every region of the world, the advance of freedom leads to peace.
Does this idealistic appeal change the arguments over Iraq? What is the administration doing to further the cause of freedom and democracy in the Middle East? And will this president be as persistent as his predecessors, or will the pressures of continued violence and slipping polls and protest convince him to change course in Iraq? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to be talking about the politics a little bit later, but joining us now to talk about the policy is Ivo Dalder, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy. He joins us from the studios at the Brookings Institution. Good to have you back on the program.
Very glad to be here.
And Robert Kagan is also with us. He's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the author most recently of Paradise and Power, America versus Europe in the New World Order. He's with us from his home in Virginia. Good to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
Ivo, let me begin with you. And, to talk about President Bush's policies, let me ask you let me use the same words that he used about Ronald Reagan's. Is his declaration of democracy in the Middle East, is this simplistic, naive, even dangerous?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, the declaration in and of itself is unobjectionable. In fact, one can argue that democratization as a principle of American foreign policy has been with us since Woodrow Wilson. In fact, the president referred to the four freedoms. Mm-hmm. That this has been a standard part of what the United States has been trying to do for well over a century, which is to make the world a better place, not only for America, but for other people, and thereby make it a better place for the United States. The real question with regard to the Middle East is, as the president himself said, for 60 years, this is not what we have been engaged in. We have not been engaged in pushing democracy in the Middle East. And the question now is, are we going to change Are we going to put democracy first and foremost in our policy with regard to Saudi Arabia and Egypt? Are we going to use the leverage that we have in order to change the direction of those countries? Are we going to make this point number one when it comes to fighting terrorism? Are we going to embrace the governments who may be targets of terrorism, or are we going to push them to liberalize quicker and more fruitfully in order to undermine those terrorists' attacks? So those are all the questions that the speech raises. In and of itself, the words are unobjectionable. In fact, they're welcome.
Robert Kagan, your reaction to this speech?
Well, I have much the same reaction, I hate to tell you, as Ivo has. I think that it's important that President Bush made this statement, because in a way he comes out of a somewhat different Republican tradition, I think, than Ronald Reagan. There are a lot of Republicans who think that it's a mistake to have such grandiose goals for American foreign policy. But Bush is really embracing the more revolutionary America that I would suggest goes back even before Woodrow Wilson. And the other really important thing I would say is that not even Ronald Reagan talked about democracy in the Middle East, and I don't think any president has. That's always been sort of the third rail. You don't want to touch those Arab monarchies and dictatorships. So I think it's quite significant that the president has actually named both Egypt and Saudi Arabia as places where change needs to occur, and that's significant. But Ivo's exactly right. It's relatively easy to give speeches. It's a lot harder to implement policies. And my concern is that in the one primary test case, which is Iraq, that while the president wants to head in this direction, it's not at all clear to me that all of his cabinet officials do, and particularly his Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld.
So you would question, I seem to be hearing this from both of you, that while these are, whether the president is actually prepared to carry out the policies dictated by these very broad goals that he talked about in terms of democracy and freedom. Eva?
Well, I mean, I don't even know whether the president wants to go much further than the speech that he has given. I mean, my sense of the president is that he doesn't necessarily think it is that hard to promote democracy, even in a region like this. My view, if you read the speech also, he keeps on talking about liberty more than democracy, the notion somehow that if you can remove the obstacles to liberty, dictatorships in particular, then people will necessarily make free choices in a way that promote democracy, that make that kind of form of government more likely. I question that. I don't necessarily think that the only reason why people aren't living in a democracy is because of dictatorship. They also want security. They also want to meet basic needs. So it is a much more complicated factor to promote democracy, as we saw, in fact, in Asia and Latin America, than the mere removal of dictators. However, that said, removing dictators, creating the circumstances in which people rise up against dictators, is clearly one of the key principles one needs to support. And the question now is for the president, what is he going to do to make that reality occur in places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt? What is he going to do in Iraq, where I have serious doubts whether we're in fact supporting this kind of policy more than any more than our rhetoric suggests?
Well, Ivo said he was Ivo Dalder just said that he was worried that they might not have the persistence of his predecessors. But Robert Kagan, if he puts this on the same scale as the long battle against communism in Europe and Asia, clearly he's not thinking of turning it around in the next month.
Well, I think I don't know, Ivo thinks he can climb inside the president's head. I think the safest assumption is the president is seriously committed to this course. And, you know, even rhetoric has a way of driving reality, as Ivo knows. I mean, when you stake out these broad claims, you do find yourself under some pressure to live up to them. I think the president has every intention of trying to push in this direction. And I think, of course, it is a long-term prospect. I mean, nobody thinks we're going to have democracy in Saudi Arabia tomorrow, but I think this is an important first step in that direction. I also think that, you know, were the United States to do well in Iraq and create a system that actually had elections within the next year or 18 months, I think that would have a very significant impact. There are elections coming up in Egypt. The pressure on the president of Egypt, Mubarak, to hold freer elections might be greater. There'd be pressure on the government in Saudi Arabia. So I think if Iraq is done well, it really could have a kind of a domino effect in the region, not overnight, but in time.
You both mentioned the references to both Saudi Arabia and Egypt. They were in another part of the president's speech. Let's listen to what he said when he was talking about what he saw as signs of positive change in the Middle East.
The Saudi government is taking first steps toward reform, including a plan for gradual introduction of elections. By giving the Saudi people a greater role in their own society, the Saudi government can demonstrate true leadership in the region. The great and proud nation of Egypt has shown the way toward peace in the Middle East and now should show the way toward democracy in the Middle East. Champions of democracy in the region understand that democracy is not perfect. It is not the path to utopia, but it's the only path to national success and dignity. As we watch and encourage reforms in the region, we are mindful that modernization is not the same as westernization. Representative governments in the Middle East will reflect their own cultures. They will not and should not look like us.
President Bush speaking on Thursday, and let's go to a phone caller. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And our guests are Ivo Dalder of the Brookings Institution and Robert Kagan of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. And our first caller is Pierrette, who's with us from Corte Madera in California.
Yes. I'm wondering how this speech may be similar to the speech that President Bush gave when he first talked about preemptive strikes. We didn't know exactly what he had in mind then, and now he's talking about something called global democratic revolution. I'm reminded of Paul Krugman's statements about how these people don't really believe in our form of government and have already started a kind of private revolution, you know, amongst themselves in the government, and what does this portend?
Paul Krugman, of course, the columnist for the New York Times. Ivo Dalder?
Well, I take this speech to be in the tradition of American foreign policy. I take Bob's point earlier that calling for democracy in the Middle East is, in fact, a step further than we have gone in the past. But for now, I think what we have is rhetoric, and we will have to see whether that rhetoric gets translated into actual policy, whether it will lead when we inevitably face the trade-off between supporting democracy and dealing with a more immediate requirement or emergency, be it in Iraq with regard to securing our soldiers, or be it in Saudi Arabia with dealing with oil or with terrorism, whether we will continue the push towards democracy. But I don't share the caller's notion or fear, really, that this is something nefarious. I think what the president is expressing is something that is deep in the American character, which is the strong belief that if other people were to live like us, we and they would be better off.
And Robert Kagan, just to follow up on that, is this in the same ballpark as the president's speech at West Point, which initially laid out the preemptive strike policy?
Well, I mean, you know, the president gives speeches and enunciates policies. I just think that the two are not the same. I think that, by the way, the whole preemption doctrine has been made too much of. But I do think that what I find significant about this speech is the naming of Saudi Arabia and Egypt. I mean, presidents can give speeches about how we ought to be promoting democracy around the world. It is significant that he would name those two, encourage reforms explicitly in Saudi Arabia, put pressure on Mubarak to hold freer elections. I'm quite sure his father, when he was president, never mentioned those countries in talking about their politics. And I would ask Ivo, but I think it's probably the case that Bill Clinton has never mentioned Saudi Arabia and Egypt in quite that way. And in that case, I must say, it's more than rhetoric. The mere fact that an American president is talking about the internal politics of Saudi Arabia and Egypt automatically has real impact on the politics in those two countries.
Pierrette, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. Correction, earlier I referred to moveout.com. The website is actually, of course, moveout.org. I apologize for that. We're discussing President Bush's vision for the Middle East and global democracy, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're discussing two recent speeches, one yesterday by former Vice President Al Gore to an event sponsored by MoveOn.org, and the one on Thursday by President Bush about democracy, not just in the Middle East, but democracy throughout the world. Our guests are Ivo Dalder, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Robert Kagan, a Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And let's get another caller on the line. Austin is with us from Bloomington, Indiana.
Yeah, Austin, I'm here.
Yes, you're on the air, Austin.
All right, thank you. I said I'm very impressed with this speech. It's like a step in the new direction. But I've been having concern about it coming from the fact that what has caused all these problems in the Middle East, part of it is the fact that American administrations have had this doctrine of national interest, protecting national interest. And I'm wondering, the new step that the president is taking, can he really establish consistency with American interests as well as relating with the administrations in the Middle East in the new policy that he's trying to forge?
And are you thinking mostly of economic interests there, Austin? I'm just trying to get a read on your question.
Well, the part of it is the economic interest and security interest. All these things come, you know, they all converge in all the policies that, you know, explain the relationship of the previous administrations and the Middle Eastern administrations.
Okay, Robert Kagan, get a response from you.
Well, it's a very smart question. It's the right question. I think, you know, at the largest level, that the pursuit of democracy overseas converges very nicely with American interests. I don't think there's any question that the world is a safer place for Americans. It's a better place for our principles when there are more democracies in the world. But in the specific instances, as Ivo has been suggesting, you know, on a day-to-day basis, there may be times when it's tough to support democracy when there are other issues at stake, like, you know, possible terrorist threats or oil or the fact that you prefer to have stable governments in place. And that's where it's always been very tricky for this administration, for the Clinton administration, and for previous administrations. And so, in a way, yes, the proof will be in the pudding when you're confronted with a real hard choice between some of these more narrowly defined security and economic interests versus the interest in promoting democracy. Which way do you go?
Ivo Dalder, do you see an approaching problem where those interests might come into collision?
Yeah, I do. I see it in Iraq as the first place. There are people in this administration and there are interests throughout the country that would like to reduce our presence, our vulnerability, the number of casualties that we are suffering because of the fight against the counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. That is, they would like to reduce our profile, and if we do so, we may stem the number of casualties. We make it a little politically a little more easy to continue the process that we're engaged in. But we also undermine the chances of succeeding in Iraq with not just overthrowing the government, but building a more stable, a more secure, a modernizing, hopefully representative, and ultimately perhaps even democratic Iraq. If that is our goal, then we have a fundamental choice to make, and we are at the point of making that choice of fighting the war and continuing the fight with more capability, more troops, I would argue, greater degree of internationalization than we have seen in the past, in order to succeed on the democracy in the democratic goals. But doing so is likely to cost more, both in dollars and in lives, than many are willing to prepare. So here we have a clear cost of a short-term interest versus a long-term interest. And this is such a difficult issue, because there are usually short-term trade-offs versus long-term trade-offs. When the long-term is good for democracy, in the short-term, it may not be.
I just want to wind up by asking Robert Kagan, one of the less prominent features of the war in Iraq has been the ability of the United States to move most of its forces, the great majority of them, out of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Does that make it easier, and again, if there is progress in Iraq, would that make it easier to put leverage on the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to reform?
Well, it certainly makes it easier if we're not counting on somebody's military base in order to be able to operate in the region. I think that makes it easier. I think, you know, Obviously, it's the case that if more Iraqi oil comes online in the years to come, then that's going to somewhat lessen, although not really entirely, certainly not entirely lessen our dependence on Saudi oil. But at the end of the day, there's always been a million reasons why any American government in any given moment wants to see, quote, stability in Saudi Arabia. I would say the biggest leverage that the Saudi government has over the United States is the fear that after the Saudi government, if it were to fall, comes some kind of radical fundamentalist government, which could itself be a base of terrorism. That's always the real fear. You know, it's sort of like, if you kill me, you know, after me, it's a much worse situation. And it requires a lot of willingness to take risks on the part of the United States to move forward on the path of reform while this possible danger always is out there lingering.
Austin, again, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. And I wanted to thank both of our guests. You just heard from Robert Kagan, a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was with us from his home in Virginia. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Ivo Dalder, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, the co-author of America Unbound, The Bush Revolution in Foreign Policy, with us from the Brookings Studios, just down the street here in Washington, D.C. Always good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
No doubt the White House will be happy if the recent address by President Bush results in a boost in approval ratings for the way he is handling the situation in Iraq. Lately, those numbers have been running the other way. Joining us now to talk about how the American public might react to the president's vision for the Middle East is Stephen Kull, director on the Program on International Policy Attitudes. He's with us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C., and thanks very much for being with us.
Good afternoon.
You've done surveys on these issues, and you've read many other surveys on these issues. How importantly do Americans value the promotion of democracy in the Middle East?
It's not a top foreign policy goal in the mind of most Americans. Only 34% said that it should be a very important foreign policy goal in a Chicago Council poll that was taken about a year ago. When presented a whole list of goals, it comes down at the bottom compared to other goals such as terrorism, proliferation of nuclear weapons, or even combating hunger. But it's still something Americans think is important. 49% said it was somewhat important, and as I said, 34% said very important. And in principle, the idea of promoting democracy is attractive to Americans. 64% said that it's a good use of foreign aid. But they are uneasy with the idea of the U.S. imposing democracy on other countries, particularly in a unilateral way.
Now, as you say, this goal ranks fairly far down on the list in terms of if there were other things Americans could do with foreign policy, it wouldn't be done next week.
Yeah, it's just not the most pressing priority in Americans' mind, and they have uneasiness about it. I mean, if the UN was organizing some major effort to promote democracy, the public would be very supportive of participating in it. But when it comes to the U.S. putting pressure on countries, for example, in a poll that we did with Knowledge Networks in April, we asked whether the U.S. should put pressure on Saudi Arabia or Egypt to become more democratic, and 67% said that it should not.
Mm-hmm.
There's an uneasiness with the idea of the U.S. playing this kind of role of world policeman.
As you look at these numbers, I mean, obviously they predate the president's speech. The kind of emphasis that the White House might put on this policy can shape public opinion, can it?
It can, but I don't. The public isn't necessarily just going to rush behind this kind of goal. When the president in during the summer talked about a Marshall Plan for the Middle East, only the public was divided as to whether the U.S. should really commit the necessary resources to try to transform the Middle East region the way the U.S. committed resources to transforming Germany after World War II.
Now, what do these surveys, including yours, show about what Americans have to say about the way that we promote democracy? How much pressure? And again, it gets back to that question of the use of force.
Well, they feel comfortable using foreign aid and encouragement, but when it comes to using military force, then they get really quite uncomfortable. If a country is doing something like committing genocide, then they do think that the U.S. should intervene, even without necessarily having U.N. approval. But as a general rule, they don't think that countries have the right to overthrow another government because it's not democratic.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a phone caller in. David joins us on the line from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Yeah, Neil. It's interesting. You know, people, I think it's a great deal of trivialization involved here when we discuss what actually would be necessary in either cultivating or projecting democracy on another sovereign state. This country, the United States, fought the most costly war in its history not quite 150 years ago in the process of deciding what type of democracy we would have here. And then we spent the next century, and really more than that because we're really not done, in civil and political struggle over what it means to be a democracy. To go in and try to impose an overlay in a region of the world that we really don't have a very good understanding of, I think the idea of being careful of what you ask for is very much in play here, because, as was said earlier, we don't know what comes after the Saudi royal family. We don't know what comes after President Mubarak or any of the other regimes that we might have on our short list of those we would like to change. Democracy, the cultivation of democracy, is a messy, and when I say messy, I mean bloody process. And you can ask any Indian citizen of a certain age of that. You know, the examples are just, I mean, history is rife with examples of what we view as successful democracies that had a very long and bloody gestation period. And I think the president and his advisors who are trying to have this forward-based imposition policy have lost, basically have a very myopic view of history.
So as you heard the president's comparisons to the struggle against communism, certainly nothing that happened very quickly, you still thought that putting it on that kind of a time frame was trivial?
Well, number one, I mean, first of all, I mean, based on what's been in the news recently coming out of Russia, I don't know that, I mean, I think Russia is very much a work in progress with respect to the cultivation of democratic principles. There's a difference between changing the Russian government to that one that is democratic and actually espouses those principles, and spending the Soviet Union into the dirt, which is what Mr. Reagan and some of his predecessors helped to do. There's no question that the expenditures that the United States made in its military and power projection worldwide forced the Soviet Union into a situation where they knew that they could not compete. That is not the same as changing the Soviet Union's fundamental tenets of government. It's just not the same thing. And kudos to Mr. Reagan, who I did not vote for being basically the capstone and doing the final act of spending the Soviets into the dirt, although I do not give him full credit. There are several presidents before him who contributed to that effort as well.
Okay,
it's just not the same as changing Russia into a democracy, which right now it still is not.
Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Stephen Cull, as you look again at these public opinion surveys, do Americans see that this administration is ready to back its words up with money and with action and to bring about democratic reform?
Well, we don't have any polling specifically on this issue, but we did ask in August whether they thought the administration was ready to commit the necessary resources to transform the Middle East along the lines of the Marshall Plan as the administration was proposing at that time. And only 39% said that they thought that the president was ready to commit the necessary resources. So I think they're probably pretty doubtful. I think that most will see this as emphasizing the principle that it's important to promote democracy as a way of justifying and legitimating the U.S. action in Iraq. They won't necessarily assume that this is a broad new program. The public feels pretty much overstretched already with Afghanistan and Iraq, and perceives the U.S. as already overstretched. And when they were they're resistant to spending more money there in Iraq, the $87 billion did not go down well with the public. So the idea that we're taking on some very expansive new project is not popular, and probably the public is dubious that the administration really has such expansionistic goals.
We're speaking with Stephen Cull, director of the Program on International Policy Attitudes. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line, and this is Gregory, who's with us from San Diego.
Yes. Hello. I would just like to say that we used over 500,000 troops and 10 years to try to make South Vietnam South Vietnam into a democracy, not even to mention North Vietnam, but South Vietnam, and we failed horribly. And I don't know how we can accomplish the same task elsewhere. It failed, and I think it's just really naive.
Gregory, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, and Stephen Kull, we wanted to thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
Stephen Kull, as I mentioned, director of the Program on International Policy Attitudes, with us online from his office in Washington, D.C. And here are a couple of the stories that NPR News is working on this afternoon. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear a case about whether foreign prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, should have access to American courts. It's the first case involving the U.S. anti-terror campaign that the Supreme Court has accepted for review. And Democratic presidential hopeful John Kerry is trying to make up ground on Howard Dean. Kerry fired his campaign manager today and replaced him with a veteran Democratic strategist. Details on those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. As President Bush continues to shape the future of American foreign policy, one of his most vocal critics is actually a voice from the past. Former Vice President Al Gore was in Washington over the weekend to deliver a blistering speech attacking the Patriot Act and the Bush administration's handling of civil liberties after September the 11th.
Our framers were also keenly aware that the history of the world proves that republics are fragile. In the very hour of America's birth in Philadelphia, when Benjamin Franklin was asked, "What have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." And even in the midst of our greatest testing, Lincoln knew that our fate here was tied to the larger question of whether any nation so conceived could long endure. This administration simply does not seem to agree that the challenge of preserving democratic freedom cannot be met unless by surrendering core American values. Incredibly, this administration has attempted to compromise the most precious rights that America has stood for all over the world for more than 200 years. Due process, equal treatment under the law, the dignity of the individual, freedom from unreasonable search and seizure, freedom from promiscuous government surveillance. And in the name of security, this administration has attempted to relegate the Congress and the courts to the sidelines.
Al Gore speaking at an event this weekend here in Washington, D.C. that was sponsored by MoveOn.org. And when we come back from the break, we're going to be discussing Al Gore's new political mantle as the Democratic Party's standard bearer, right in the midst of a campaign by nine other Democrats to get the presidential nomination. Al Gore repeated in that speech that he is a recovering politician and waved off calls for "Run, Al, Run." If you're interested in this question, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Al Gore retreated after the 2000 presidential election. The symbol was the beard that he grew. But since his announcement that he would not run again in 2004, the former vice president has transformed his role in the Democratic Party. In August, he blasted the Bush administration's foreign policy. Yesterday, he gave a second speech in a periodic series, this one charging that the administration's reaction to 9/11 was unnecessary, excessive, and counterproductive, and a dangerous erosion of American civil liberties. His sudden emergence as the party's voice of criticism dusts off a political role not seen for a while. Joining us now is Professor Betty Glad, who teaches political science at the University of Southern California. She's with us. South Carolina. I apologize. I apologize. I saw that SC and I just made an assumption. She's with us from her office in Columbia, South Carolina. Nice of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Happy to be with you.
If you have thoughts about Al Gore's new role in the Democratic Party, join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And Betty Glad, is there a history of former high-ranking politicians, presidents and vice presidents, criticizing their successors?
Absolutely. We have a myth that they don't, but if you look at all the presidents, former presidents, who when they resigned were in their 50s, they have all played a very active role afterwards. Theodore Roosevelt campaigned against Taft in 1912 under the a program that was more liberal, more progressive than his opponent. And then he ran, essentially, then he had the formed the Bull Moose Party in 1912 and ran against Woodrow Wilson. In 1916, he criticized Wilson. Essentially, he was almost going to run for president again in 1920, but he died, unfortunately, before that could happen. Taft went on to work for the League of Nations and talk about that and became Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Hoover partook of the Hoover Commissions, which looked at how you could give the president more power to manage the government. And Clinton in Clinton, who's retired at 54, of course, is speaking out on issues. And but you know, it's also interesting because a lot of Republicans have done it, aside from the ones I've just mentioned. Ford, interesting enough, came out and was a co-founder of the People for the American Way because he was opposed to the moral majority taking over the Republican Party. Did you know that?
I did not know that. The curiosity, of course, is that this comes in the midst of a Democratic campaign to select a nominee to run against President Bush. And is Al Gore trying to steal the limelight here?
I don't think that. He may be preparing the way for if there's a loss for a future win. I think it's a little late for him to be entering to get the money now and to field all the delegates when so many of them have already gone in the field and people have made their commitments. So I think that, you know, he's setting himself up, if insofar as he's concerned about his own political interest with, you know, if they falter, what happens thereafter. But he also is sort of, in a sense, is trying to embolden the Democrats more generally and I think lead them into, I think, a very important consideration of this Patriot Act, which I agree with him. If you look at the particulars, does threaten American liberties.
Here's an email question from Wendell Brown in Little Rock. Has a defeated major party presidential candidate ever won the nomination for that party for the following elections? And if so, what was the result?
Okay, I'm trying to think.
My first name that leaps to mind is Adlai Stevenson.
No, Adlai Stevenson certainly didn't win.
No, a defeated major party candidate ever won the nomination for that party for the following elections.
No, not that I can think of.
So once they're out with their, I guess.
You know, as I said, you know, Roosevelt would have Theodore Roosevelt would have had the Republican nomination back in 1920 if he had not died beforehand. He was still a relatively young man then.
And I guess John Adams ran again, but for Congress, not for president.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So it can happen.
Okay. Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Martin, who's on the line with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi. How you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about what Al Gore said in his speech. I think that Al Gore hit the nail on the head when he talks about this administration's erosion of American civil liberties. Vis-a-vis the policy with the Middle East and Iraq, I think it's naive because we've been to several different locations, you know, worldwide to try and bring democracy, and they've all failed. And then sooner or later, those countries reflect inwardly, and democracy follows.
Martin, you're talking. Martin's talking about what we spoke about in the earlier segment on President Bush's speeches last week on freedom in the Middle East.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Now, what about Gore's role as statesman, the standard bearer for the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, I think I would distinguish between being a standard bearer and being a statesman, and I think a lot of presidents want to be known as statesmen, or a lot of former presidential candidates want to be known as statesmen. And they are. You know, these people are not simply running for office. They also have a real substantive, oftentimes passionate interest in politics. So they're experienced, and they want to talk about it. And I don't think we should always just look at their ambitions. So, you know, that's maybe relevant. I think that, you know, this is something that needs to be talked about, and it has not received the attention it should. And I think Gore's trying to, as a statesman, trying to bring it up to and put it on the public agenda. So, you know, I think that he has a real substantive interest in doing that, not just running for president right now.
Well, one of the reasons he retreated after, in the immediate aftermath of the election, the highly disputed election, of course, and declined all comment for quite some time, was that anything he said might well be perceived as sour grapes.
That's true. And then also, you have to look at when people are defeated, they oftentimes go through a period of depression. Carter did after he was defeated. Nixon did after he retired, and I think Gore probably did after his defeat. And they, what did I do wrong? You know, why didn't I make it? Why did the people reject me? And so before they feel confident again, they have to, you know, reassemble themselves and rethink their thoughts and what role they can play. And, you know, Nixon, after a while, became a statesman again and began playing that role. He had certainly no ambitions for running again, but he spoke out on various foreign policy issues.
Let's get a call in from Robert in Burlington, Vermont.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of Richard Nixon, you asked a question earlier about any candidate who lost the election and came back, and Richard Nixon, I immediately thought Richard Nixon. I was kind of surprised you missed that.
I am too.
Yeah, you're right.
And the amazing thing was is that, you know, he not only lost to Kennedy in 60, you know, he ran for governor of California and could not even win that. And then it was the you don't have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore thing. You thought you would think that he was like defeated and completely, you know, the stake driven into his heart completely. And yet he came back and with a vengeance in 68.
One of the things that I was asked about a successive presidential campaign, and there was that hiatus when he was vice president, which gave him a renewed stature.
Greg Camp wrote us an email from Nashville, Tennessee, saying William Jennings Bryan was Democratic nominee three times, starting in 1896.
That's true.
And George Madden in Tulsa, Oklahoma, said the answer is Reagan, who lost the nomination to Ford, but came back 4 years later.
Yeah,
but that's not quite the same.
He didn't win the nomination.
Though. No. Thanks very much for the call, Robert. Appreciate
sure.
it. And very quickly, as we wrap up this conversation, Betty Glad, there are nine other candidates, as we've mentioned. Why does the Democratic Party need Al Gore to be making these speeches?
Well, I think that these nine people have gotten so involved in criticizing each other, they've forgotten to address major policy issues. And I think they're hurting each other, and that Gore is paying a real statesmanlike role for the party here, saying, hey, guys and lady, let's focus on the issues and quit sniping at each other. And I think that's a very positive role for him to play.
Yeah, on the other hand, one of them has to emerge victorious over the others before he can start making the speeches that Al Gore has been making.
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, I think that would be a smarter strategy to be victorious by showing that you can articulate issues the best. You know, if you go back to 1912, you know that essentially between Taft and Teddy Roosevelt, there was a major debate about the new nationalism versus a more limited government. They based it on different governmental philosophies.
Just have a few seconds left, but would you be surprised to see Al Gore make a speech like this after a nominee's been selected?
Oh, I think that, yeah, I think he would. I think that I don't think it's practical for him to aspire to the presidential nomination yet, so I don't think that's motivating him.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Betty Glad is a professor of political science at the University of South Carolina. She joined us from their campus in Columbus, South Carolina. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.